ahead and pick the speed up. Your number one now, runway 27, clear to land green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Green Dot, EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. The Green Dot is sponsored by Crew Chief Systems, the smarter way to manage, maintain, and safeguard your aircraft's value. My name is Chris Henry. I'm the museum manager here, and I will be your host today. Not necessarily flying solo. We have an amazing guest. Across the table from me is someone who I've admired since I first met her here last summer, Lieutenant Colonel Anita Mack. Anita, thank you for being here.
It's good to be here. Thanks.
Well, it's my favorite question to ask everybody, and you'll be no different here. As I always ask everybody, what first really got you excited to want to fly?
So I grew up next to Langley Air Force Base in Virginia, and my dad worked at NASA Langley, and he designed supersonic aircraft for NASA. So I would see the F-15s flying all the time, and it was just always there. So I didn't even think about it. It was so intrinsic, I didn't even think about that. And then later on, I grew up, and I was like, wow, that's really cool.
Wow.
So it was always around it.
That's awesome. That had to be pretty special to grow up around Langley.
Well, when you grow up around it, you don't realize that everyone doesn't grow up that way. So I thought that was normal to have, you know, jets screaming overhead, because we were literally over the in the pattern. So they would fly right over the house all the time.
Oh, wow.
And then because it was headquarters, they would do the first F-15 demo, or the Thunderbird would show up. So you were always getting free air shows.
That's awesome. That's a good way to be.
So yeah, I just kind of, it was just in the blood.
Oh, that's cool. That is awesome. So you're here speaking at the museum tonight about your Air Force career. How did you decide to go there out and go into the Air Force?
So really roundabout and tortuously slow. I went to college. I thought I was going to go to ROTC, and I decided I just couldn't hack it. I wouldn't be good enough. And so I didn't. And then I graduated, and I worked and had a lot of jobs. And when I finally had some money, I started flying at the Langley Aero Club. And my brother, David, older brother, figured everything out for me. That's the great thing about being the middle child. You don't have to learn anything on your own. So he showed me how I could get my private pilots through the Aero Club. And my instructor was a Vietnam bird dog driver and retired from the Army. And so he was a big coach and big inspiration. So we'd be flying along, and he'd say, well, why aren't you flying those, you know, airlines or F-15s or whatever? And so that kind of put the idea in my head that I could do it. And then I was a paramedic at the time, and it was in the inner city, lots of trauma. And after that experience, I figured if I could handle that, I could handle something like the Air Force, you know, might be. Yeah. So then I guess I had the confidence to try. And then I had a really big bad day, and I was like, anything's got to be better than this. So I was 100% committed. And it's funny, when you commit, things just happen.
Wow. So I didn't know you were a paramedic. That's my dad was a paramedic. I worked on air ambulances for a while. That's a powerful field to be in. I mean, that is it's tough. It's not an easy one.
No, but I really loved it. I loved the trauma. It was very high-paced, but it was not a job that you made a career out of. It would break you. So,
yeah, it was a job. From my perspective, it was a job you couldn't go in tired and just kind of like walk your way through it. And like, I'll just get through this shift, and you know, and get it. You had to give it your all every day.
100% head on a swivel, had to be engaged in what was going on, especially in the inner city.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. We were in Pittsburgh, so same.
Yeah.
Wow. That's impressive. So tell me about your first, you know, going in and actually signing up for the Air Force. What's that like to go in there and say, I'm ready, I'm going to do this?
Well, it's funny. So I wanted to be an officer because I wanted to fly. And you have to go find an officer recruiter because there's only two per state. And I had a lot of people trying to get me to enlist, but I was already a pilot. That's what I wanted to do. So when I finally got in touch, my understanding is they don't get credit for getting an officer. They want the enlisted people. So that was sort of an afterthought. But like I said, when you're really motivated for a new job, then you push hard. And I don't know. It was. I tell you, the one thing that really I remember out of the entire thing was I went the day to enlist, because you enlist before you go to officer candidate school or officer training school. So you stand and you raise your right hand and you're in a room with 20, 30 people and it's all over. And the guy who just gave you the oath said, "Hey, you see that girl in the back?" And I was literally in the back corner. And he said, "That girl's going to be your boss one day. She's going to be an officer." And all these eyes turned and looked at me. And I was like, nothing like being singled out. You know, I haven't done anything. So that's what I remember.
Yeah. So from there, you start into basic.
I went to officer training school, okay. Which is basic training. They call it the 90-day wonder because we were there for 4 months. But
wow. You know.
Yeah, you. Again, it's only meant for people who already had your degrees, or it was probably 75% prior enlisted. So they all knew what was going on, and they were coaching me because I was an idiot. I didn't know anything. I didn't know how to spell OI. So, yeah.
Well, and where was that? Like, what base?
Maxwell in Alabama, Montgomery, okay. Alabama.
Awesome. So you didn't have to go to Lackland.
No, that's only enlisted.
Okay. Okay. Perfect.
Yeah.
And So tell us a little bit about, like, what was your first impression to be in there? I mean, your first few days had to be sort of a shock to your system.
It was a huge shock. I wasn't used to being yelled at. I mean, I expected it, but you're not used to it. And then it was very strange. That first morning after you wake up, they pull you into the hallway at a crazy hour, and you're just standing there. You don't know what's going on. And what was crazy was one guy passed out and he ended up washing out. And then somebody else was like, "I don't need to be talked to this way," and quit already. So people were falling out before we even got started. It was the very first morning.
Wow.
So people call it the game. Once you figured out how it worked, it was totally doable. But you just, me being fresh off the streets, it was definitely a culture shock.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Did you encounter a leader there along the way that is special for you, that you look back on with fondness?
So I was surrounded with really great enlisted people who really coached me along, and that was great. But everyone remembers their flight commander. So I remember the captain, and he had been an Air Force Academy boxer. So fitness... Let me just say, we did a ton of push-ups and sit-ups, and he was really good at yelling. It was real art. So, and he had very high standards. He would not let us embarrass him. So, it was.
Now, did you have your sights set on a specific airframe yet, or how did that come into play?
So I had wanted to be a pilot, and they said, "You cannot be a pilot because your eyes are too bad. If you were already in the Air Force, we'd let you be a pilot, but you can't come in as one." So I didn't know how it worked, how you would get your airframe. But weirdly enough, they pulled everyone out of a class at OTS, and they said, "Here's a yellow piece of paper. Write down the airframe you want to be a navigator on." And so I was like, "I don't know, C-130, because I didn't want to be on a tanker. I didn't want to do circles in the sky. But kids who didn't have any concept of the Air Force were writing down like F-16 navigator, and that doesn't exist, right? So it, in a way, it was unfair to set up. These kids just didn't have any concept. So they would track you fighter, bomber, or heavies. And I don't know how they decided it. To this day, they picked two guys. They said, "You're going to be fighter, bomber, track," and everybody else would track heavy. So that's just what happened. And then you go to your heavy school, and then you have your night where you get to pick your airplane based on your class ranking. And I was very fortunate. I got my squadron the squadron I wanted and the airframe I wanted. So you can't get luckier than that.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit, you know, back up slightly. What's navigator training like? Like what all do you do? I mean, obviously you train to be a navigator, but how rigorous is it, and what kind of stuff do you do there?
The whole concept behind any Air Force training is that they try to overload you to induce stress, and how do you handle the stress? So at OTS, you had 26 hours of work to do in 24 hours, and you had to decide where you wanted to sleep. You know, is that sort of testing your judgment and testing your strength, your stress? So in navigator school, you learn the basics of the old-time navigator. But when I went through, they were changing the program. So we did not do celestial navigation, which I kind of feel like I got cheated out of. We didn't do pressure. We didn't do the all the old arts. They focused more on the modern stuff, like how does the GPS work? How does it fail? How do you fix it? So it was a little more technology oriented, but it was a ton of doing high level navigation and then low level navigation. And it takes roughly 9 to 10 months to get through that. And it is every day, 8 to 12 hours a day. Again, high stress, and you're being graded all the time. So your performance determines your class status, which determines your airframe. So there's a lot of people who get really stressed out because, you know, you have one bad day and it could kick you down a couple places.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. That, and how long was your navigator training course?
So basic joint specialized undergraduate navigator training was about 9 to 10 months. It changes based on where you're at. And then after that, you go to survival schools, and then you go to your special, your airframe. So then you go to your, it's called FTU, formal training unit. And so that was C-130s for me. And then from there, you go to your squadron. But even when you're in your squadron, you still are learning, and you're in a student mode for probably the first 3 to 6 months, depending on how often you fly. But you go through this whole in-doc training, and then every phase of mission that you do, like if you do low level, high level, everything is a training folder. And so again, everything, you're constantly being graded and you're constantly studying, and it takes about 2 to 3 years to really be established once you start the training to be kind of full up.
I got to ask about survival training. That had to be interesting. What's that like?
Another eye opener. I learned that those little packets of jalapeno cheese, I thought they were the greatest things ever. And then I realized when you're not hungry, they're pretty nasty. But oh my gosh, it was the best thing I'd ever had when I was on the side of the mountain. So you go to Fairchild, and I went in May. So it was still snowy and cold, but in the afternoons it could get warm enough that it'd be great hiking weather. And you learn to evade, and again the whole thing is a pressure cooker. How do you handle you being the lead or you being the a teammate? And so you do classroom portion, and you go out in the field, you evade, or you learn how to survive, and then you go back in the classroom, and then they teach you how to survive in a hostile situation.
Wow.
So wow. 3 weeks, roughly. And then I lost about 7 pounds when I was out in the field.
Jeez.
In a week, yeah. It was pretty typical. Everyone was, because they don't give you any food. They give you, we got 2 MREs and 2 chickens to last a week. And so, yeah.
That's not a lot.
But it's huge about teamwork. And I think that's really what made it fun. I mean, I really did, in hindsight, I didn't enjoy it at the time, but it really was fun because you were a team.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. I don't know if I'd want to do it, but
no, I don't recommend it.
So that you get to, start your C-130 training actually, out with the airplane. What's your first impression of it when you walk up to it, knowing that you're now going to be on a C-130 crew?
Super intimidating. This has such a storied legacy and all the crews before that did great things. And then you're overwhelmed because there's a lot to do, and obviously you can't fail, because you don't fail yourself. You fail your team, and then you might fail the guys in the back or the guys on the ground. So a lot of pressure. And every time you fly, you're being judged. And it's not in a harsh way, although the techniques can be harsh, but it's always to make you better. And what I loved about the 130, after I had looked around at other communities, is that they really pushed hard that you were the best, that you could be, you're 100%, and that they really didn't tolerate the lackadaisical, half-hearted. It was all or nothing. So it's pretty intimidating to walk up to that airplane. It's pretty ugly, and it's pretty cool looking, and you get those engines rumbling, and you just stand outside it and you feel it just at idle, and you're just like, it takes your breath away. I mean, literally, it takes your breath away, but it's so cool.
I always like the line they say when you know, in the last, like, you know, put in whatever airplane, C-17 or whatever, is retired in a boneyard, the crew get a ride home in a C-130.
Yes.
You know? So, it's just one of those legacy airframes.
Yes. Yeah. And it does, I don't even have words. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
What does a typical day look like for a navigator on a C-130? Like, how does it, you know, what's it start like with briefing, and what do you do en route with the airplane as well?
So pretty much our bread and butter is low level, and which is a total blast. So navigators show up generally about 5 hours early for the flight. They have to, you do your normal stuff. You check your, it's the military version of NOTAMs and weather, and you get, you have paperwork to do. And then navs sit down and they start doing carps and logs. So computed air release points. You have a load. It could be a person, personnel, container system, or it could be a vehicle. And you're going to drop it out at this altitude. So you've got to get all the details about what are you dropping, where are you dropping it at, what's the weather. And then you compute this computed air release point, this carp. And that takes quite a bit of time. And again, when I went through, a normal formation was 6 airplanes. So you would have 6 crews doing all this work. And it was a lot of divide and conquer. So you have to do charts. You have to, you have a DZ, a drop zone mosaic that you have, and you plot your carp and you plan how you're going to do this drop. You have to plan the low level mission. What TOT, time on target, do you have? So that backs up when you can take off and what routes you can do. And so the navs are all doing this stuff, planning the whole day. You have a formation briefing. Everyone sits in, all crew members. And then you have a formation just for the pilots and navs. You step to the airplane, you pre-flight for the nav, you go in the back and you check to make sure your cargo, your load is correct, and that it's what you've planned. And then you start engines, and a typical low level was a 5-hour mission. Wow. 4 routes, low level, high level, take a break, low level, high level. And when I say high level, it's, we had this system, it was called SKI, station keeping equipment. And basically it was to be an at night, all weather, higher altitude. So in this case, we trained at between 4,000 and 6,000 feet. Low level was 300 feet. So with SKI, you'd be a formation, you'd be practicing that you couldn't see anything, and you had special equipment that you would broadcast when the lead was going to turn, and then the wingman would hit a timer, and then when his time was done, he turned, because you didn't have any indication except for a little dot on a little screen. And so to be in position, your timing was critical, and lead passing that signal was critical, and you did the whole everything that way. You did the drop that way. So lead would signal his green light and you would time off of that. And it was all timing. You couldn't see anything. So high level would airdrop is an art to itself, very intense. Cause you can't get behind. If you miss a signal,
you're behind.
So anyways, that was a typical training mission. And we flew, especially when you're young, 3 to 4 times a week, generally 3.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. I mean, that's a lot more, I mean, it almost sounds like a B-17 mission or something. When you start talking about, you know, you're following your lead and, you know, following, turns and things like that.
Yeah. And especially for number 6, it really matters that everyone in the middle got their cues correct. And we were doing this on the old equipment, E's and H's. So they didn't have a lot of the modern stuff, and we didn't necessarily have moving map GPS stuff. When the C-130 on E's and H's, our GPS was, or our movie map was a laptop we brought with us. It was not part of the airplane. Wow. Our GPS pucks we would put in the window. They were external because the ones on the airplane weren't certified. So we were adapting a lot. So the old airplane, adapting to new technology, was mostly external many times. So then you had a lot of equipment to handle. And then after a formation, you would do the debrief. And with 6 ships, it could be an exciting debrief, depending on how the day went. Or it could be super chill. And the great thing was back then, you always did it in the Heritage Room with a beer. And it was brutal. I hated flying for the first 3 or 4 years because everything you did was scrutinized. Was that the right thing to do? And it was all to make you better. But it sure sucks being made better in front of everybody. And because when you're flying, everybody sees you. Oh, she missed that. Oh, well, you know, she's young or whatever, you know. Yeah. So you always want to be the guy not screwing up.
It's funny you mentioned that, that, you know, the push to be better is necessary, but not fun. I was an air traffic controller, and, you know, there were times where there might be a disagreement between pilot and air traffic, and everything's recorded. And there is no test of your nerves than when they have to pull that recording and you're like, I think I said it right, but here comes the, you know, you're in front of a room of people and you're like, let's see if I screwed up, you know. And that's a, even if you're right, that buildup is a hard few seconds there, you know, you're learning that lesson.
And your reputation is everything. Mm-hmm. So you didn't want to have the reputation as the person who couldn't fly the way out of a paper bag. So you tried very hard during the flight. I studied like crazy all the time. We would have the young navs, especially when you're brand new to a squadron, you sit around and you study a lot and hangar fly a lot. And then hopefully it pays off in the debrief. But when you get to be like year three or four, you're starting to, you understand everything, you anticipate things, you know the flow, and you can sort of relax, and then it becomes a blast.
That's cool.
Yeah.
The stories we have today are really interesting, but before we go any further, I do want to take a moment to acknowledge our sponsor. They are some of the people who help make the Green Dot possible. And that is Crew Chief Systems. Are you still relying on paper logs or manual spreadsheets to manage your aircraft? It's time to elevate your approach. Crew Chief Systems puts your airplane at the center of real-time aircraft asset intelligence, allowing you to fly safer, save time, and protect your aircraft's value. Crew Chief's intuitive platform unifies all of your maintenance, compliance, and operational data, giving you instant access to your aircraft's full history, upcoming requirements, and real-time insights directly from your mobile device or computer. Whether you're a pilot, fleet manager, or mechanic, Crew Chief Systems helps you stay compliant, make smarter decisions, and keep your aircraft in peak condition. Visit crewchiefsystems.com to see how you can modernize your aircraft management. And as a special thank you to Green Dot listeners, you can save 15% for the lifetime of your Crew Chief GA subscription when you use coupon code GREEN15. That's GREEN15 at crewchiefsystems.com. Thank you again so much to Crew Chief Systems for sponsoring the Green Dot and helping make it possible. Now let's get back to the rest of the story. So tell me about rotating out to the unit that you wanted after training. What was that unit? Where were you?
So I went to Dyess Air Force Base. I was in the 40th Airlift Squadron. And training was at Randolph in San Antonio. So I loaded up my very few possessions into a U-Haul, and I went 4 hours up the road. And I said, before I joined the Air Force, send me anywhere but Texas. And then I didn't leave for like 6 years. it was great because the 40th had, there was two squadrons there, the 39th and the 40th, but we were AMC units, tenant units on an ACC base. So we didn't have to do a lot of the normal stuff. We weren't part of that team, so we did our own thing, and the airspace was wide open. So we could really push the envelope and do some crazy stuff that now you would never be able to do. Because back then you were allowed to fail. And so if you had a mission where a training mission and it didn't work out so well, your plan fell apart, that was still a success because you figured out what didn't work.
Yeah.
And we could just have so much fun out there. Again, it wasn't always fun. It was fun in hindsight, but it was the best environment to learn it, to grow up in, because if I had gone to a base that had a lot of airspace and you'd be very rigid about what you could do, it just wouldn't have had that learning.
Yeah. Now, and how did it work with crews? Like, were you guys always the same crew, or did you fly with a lot of different people?
Flew with everybody. You never had a hard crew unless you deployed or you were sitting alerts. And of course, alerts didn't happen until after September 11th. Before that, we didn't have any of that stuff. If you went TDY, obviously, you could be out on the road for a while. And there'd be stories about crews that would they were tasked to go to, let's say, Puerto Rico for a 3-day trip, and they'd come back a month later and they had been all the way up to like Newfoundland. Because once you're on the road, you could be tasked to do anything. So there was always stories that I grew up with where you packed winter and summer in the same suitcase. But if you were just doing a normal, if you weren't TDY and you're just at home station, you flew with everybody.
Wow. When was your first deployment? Was it after 9/11 or before?
It was after. We had already been planned to deploy in November, and we actually left the day after Thanksgiving. So that had all been planned. It was all a steady rotation, and I was lucky enough to go to Germany. But because of September 11th and everything changing, we split the unit. So half went to Kuwait and half went, or correction, they went to Oman, and then half went to Germany. And then we were only there, Ramstein, for 3 weeks, and they forward deployed us to Kuwait. So I was all excited to spend Christmas in Germany, and instead I got to leave on the 23rd to go set up for the squadron. We were what's called ADVON, so you're the advanced team that makes sure the squadron is ready to be received. And then the rest of the squadron flew over on C-130s over at, like, New Year's, or correction, Christmas Eve over the pyramids.
Wow.
So, cool story. It sucked because, you know, what we all wanted to go be a part of the fight. Don't get me wrong. That wasn't it. But a lot of people had families that were going to visit, and so plans changed.
Yeah. How did you feel going to the desert? How did that?
So my first deployment was a little overwhelming, but the Air Force is also not stupid. They make a crew based on experience. So I had a highly experienced pilot, load masters. My engineer was amazing. And then I was brand new. I don't know, I maybe had 300-400 hours. So it was a little overwhelming, but you practice the mission every day. And so that wasn't the concern. It was, again, just, this is all new and I got to figure out something new and don't screw it up. A common theme.
I use that too. So. You know, was it different having to try to navigate in the desert where there can't be a lot of like dead reckoning or anything out there?
Right. So everything in the desert is high level, truly high level, get up and cruise. So we had the GPS, the movie maps, and we had all that stuff. You're right. The first Gulf War, they had a hard time doing the dead reckoning navigation stuff. So for us, it was not a problem. We would just program the computer, and I would follow with a laptop. And so we would have backups to stuff. That was, navigating was not difficult. But it was learning new procedures. A lot of the stuff had not been developed. So when we went to Afghanistan, we didn't have radar. So how do you control aircraft when you don't know where anybody is? So we had what was called PIFR routes, procedural IFR. So you had a start point and an entry time, and you had to hit your time. And then you would be on your route at your altitude, and there would be somebody above you and below you going a different way. So inbound and outbound. And that entry time, your block time, was really, really important. So you'd have to hit that. And then, again, we didn't have good radars at the bases, so you would have sectors that you would come in on, and so you'd have to make sure that you hit your sector and you're in the right place at the right time, again, and talking to air traffic control. And there was some learning on ATC and for the crews about how we meshed this whole thing together.
You know, it's so interesting to hear you talk about that. I've never heard about that. But it almost sounds like lessons that were like first learned during like the Berlin airlift.
Absolutely.
Or something like that.
Absolutely.
Okay, cool. Yeah. I was like, boy, that sounds a lot similar.
Oh, know? Yeah. And part of that too, so we only flew at night into what's called the box, the combat zone. And so you only flew at night. You flew at the time, when we first started out, we didn't fly with MEGs. When you flew on a 130 low level at night, that was unaided. So we got over there and somebody decided we needed to fly on NVGs. And normally you go to a training school there's a training program that someone has figured out at headquarters. And they basically said, this is what Spec Ops does. This is how you use an NVG. Go out and figure it out. And so we were being trained in combat. It was really unique. I can't think of another time where we had a technology that we implemented in combat.
Yeah. What were some of the challenges learning to fly on MVGs? I got to do it a little bit and it was interesting.
A lot of it, so I can't talk to the pilot side. I mean, I hear what they say, but for me, I had to always look below the NVG. So I was looking at a clipboard. Navigators stand in the window, especially at that time, because we were expecting Russia's Afghanistan. So the minute you were in the combat zone, nav was in the window, loadmasters were in the windows. We were all looking for threats. So you were looking through the MVGs. I was looking under the MVGs at a clipboard or at my desk or at the movie map. So it was weird where you had to have it far enough away that you could see through the MVGs clearly, but also be able to look below. And then funny enough, when you're standing and you're standing in the window, you're always hitting your MVGs on something and knocking your head around. And and C-130s are amazing airplanes, but everything hurts. So you're constantly getting knocked into,
the first time you're really going to cross into combat, that had to be an interesting feeling.
Yeah. Honestly, I don't remember it. I just really remember the time to get to work sort of attitude of it was an honor. We all wanted to be part of the mission. We all wanted to support the guys on the ground. And again, don't screw it up.
You know, you talk about getting into the fight, and I can remember at that time period, the aircraft were wearing like the Let's Roll nose art,
yeah,
you know, and things like that.
Yeah. So our ground crews were amazing, and they would do chalk. They would do chalk drawings. And so you never knew when you're going to get a new chalk drawing. I wish now desperately that I had taken pictures. It's amazing the things you don't think of, especially my first three deployments. I don't think I only have a few pictures because let's face it, you didn't really have a camera that you put in your pocket or disposable camera sucked. And I don't know. I think back of the things that I wish I had tracked.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Do you remember any of the funny nose art or names that stand out? Are there any that you
could... Well, we had 666. That was the tail number, and it was a devil, and it would bite you. We all feared 666. And to this day, if you go to a C-130 blog, you can find a reference to it.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. Damien, that's what we called it. And it was a lot of Let's Roll, and then something personal to the crew chief. So like I said, it was almost like World War II nose art. I wish I had tracked it.
Oh, that's super cool. Yeah. I love it. I'm a lover of nose art, and I love the stories behind it. And so that's really cool to hear.
Well, I'm going to tack on top of that. So it was all tents, and you had a wood door. There was very little wood initially there. And so we had this one wood door, and then the maintainers would go and put art on the doors. And that, again, wish I had tracked all that stuff.
That's
super cool.
Yeah, it's like a little nugget of history that you know a lot of people don't know about.
Yeah.
That's super fun. So let me ask you about the famous, picture out there of you as part of an all-woman C-130 crew. How did that come to be, and what was that about?
I don't know the background. My squadron commander was flying on our crew that day, and he said, Mac, what would you think about doing an all-female crew? And I was like, well, I'm just here to do my job, but it caught traction, and obviously there had to be a waiver, because at the time you could only have one woman on each crew. You couldn't have more than one woman. And that was always a consideration as when you're building your crews. I was a nav scheduler for a while. So not only going back to the people's skills and experience level, you also... you only have one woman on the crew. So it would start out as rumor, and then it turned into a thing. And then it was the only time of all my days of flying that we had women in every crew position to do it. After that, we didn't have, say, an engineer or a loadmaster. So I don't know. It just turned into a thing. And then one day, I was pulled off my hard crew and flew this mission. And you know what my hard crew did, though? They flew this guy. What's his name? He's in a lot of movies. He's real tall. Vince Vaughn. Yeah. And so normally when you fly a DV around, distinguished visitor, they fly one leg. You don't talk to them. They sit in the back. They've got their handlers. They do their thing. Oh, no. Now, this is according to my crew. And as we all know, it only has to be 10% true. So, no, he was sitting on the flight deck. He was on the crew bunk. When they were, he did like three legs with these guys. And when we were refueling, when they were refueling, he was sitting out there smoking with the loadmasters, you know, just being a regular Joe. So I don't know who got the better flight there.
Well, on the flip side of the coin, what was your mission that you guys did? Can you talk about what?
Yeah, so it's fairly funny. There's two generic missions in Afghanistan. It was all cargo initially. And in Iraq, it was 56 and 2, 56 troops and 2 baggage pallets. And you would do that constantly, day in and day out. So that's what we did. We did 2 legs into Baghdad, 56 and 2. And that was when it was pretty hot. Fallujah was going on, that kind of stuff. So we had to really worry about, we call it being in the WEZ, the weapon engagement zone. So you had to worry about where you're flying. We had no fly zones because helicopters kept being shot down. And so it was a typical day. Everybody else was doing the same mission we were doing, but it was just different because we were, yeah.
I have to tell you, that is a powerful picture, though. To see an all-woman C-130 crew going into harm's way to bring troops and supplies. It's a cool picture. I mean,
well, I have to tell you, perhaps this is too much behind the curtain, but that was the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And days were typically 12 to 16 hours. It's 120 degrees. You've been working all day, and this guy wants to take some pictures. And our conversation earlier, all you want to do is go sit in the air conditioner and you're tired and hungry. So I'm really surprised that picture is as good as it is.
Everybody was done.
Everyone was done.
Well, how many times did you deploy?
I did 11 times.
Wow.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Where all were you that you can talk about?
So the first deployment was Germany, Kuwait, Doha, which is Qatar. And then there's a lot of Kuwaits. There was a Masira Island, which is Oman, Manas, in Kyrgyzstan. I did an Iraq tour. I was meant to go be in Iraq. And then because of Iran shooting rockets and COVID, I didn't actually make, I sat in Kuwait the whole time. And then I did an Afghanistan tour.
Wow. Wow. That's incredible. Yeah. Wow. And you retired not that long ago from the Air Force.
Just a little couple weeks more than a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
So I enlisted on Friday the 13th, and I retired. My last day was leap year, February 29th.
Wow. And I mean, to rise to the rank of lieutenant colonel, that is impressive. That has to feel good. It has to mean something to you that your career was as successful as it was.
It certainly was, especially I was never going to stay in. I was going to do my 6 years. I was getting out. I raised my hand, and 5 minutes later, when can I get out? You know, I was already retiring. I was always planning my exit, and I was just having too much fun. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's not fun, but I was having too much fun. I loved the team concept. I loved the mission. And then all of a sudden, it had been a long time, and so what's validating is not. I mean, the rank is nice. What's validating is when your crews depend on you and they want your friendship. They want you in their circle. They want you on their crew. That's what's validating.
Yeah, that means a lot.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't come easy. It doesn't come, they don't just give that to you.
Reputation will destroy you. If you have one bad day, if you do one stupid move, your reputation is gone. That's all you had in the 130s.
Yeah.
And so for me to have a high reputation was priceless. It was my most valued possession.
Oh, that's remarkable. Yeah. So how I met you, here I am going out with Sean in the B-29 to Olathe. And there's just this cool lady talking about her L-Bird. And that's,
yeah, I'd like to meet her. Where is she?
and it's you. And they're like, oh, and by the way, I believe it was Sean and Steve Zimmerman that were like, you need to talk to her. Like, that should be a cool museum speaker, which is why you're here.
Should listen to Better Counsel.
But tell me a little bit about the airplane that you fly today and the story that you're preserving with it.
So I am lucky enough to own, it's a Piper J5C. The Navy variation was an HE-1, and it's an World War II air ambulance, and it was actually out in the Pacific. It was stationed at Pearl Harbor, Peleliu, Guam. Funny enough, Norfolk Naval Base, which is right down the road where I grew up, 30 minutes, so that's really special to me, Pensacola. So you can see where it was stationed, how it traveled throughout the war. But yeah, it actually served. And I feel like I'm a steward. I'm lucky enough to be taking care of this piece of history. And my goal is simply to keep it going for the next person to take over.
Oh, and what I love that you do with that airplane is I love folks who are passionate about being good stewards of the aircraft. And they're telling that story, you know, especially when it's a story that maybe it doesn't get out there or it doesn't get a lot of the films and movies and, you know, TV shows and stuff. You know, I'll always love the P-51 and the heavy bombers and things, but we know that 12 o'clock high and Memphis Belle and that stuff has always preserved that. I really, really enjoy the people that are taking pieces of history that we maybe don't know a ton about, you know, like this Piper, and telling that story with it of these aircraft also served, you know, they were certainly frontline aircraft. Yeah. And, you know, the people that were brave enough to fly them were flying basically general aviation airplanes into harm's way.
Yes.
I mean, that is, to me, that's always crazy. Even going forward into the Vietnam, you know, the fat guys and stuff like that. To me, that was always crazy that at the end of the day, it's like, that's just a Cessna, you know, that they're flying like over the jungles of Vietnam.
Yeah. It's a very humble airplane. They only made 100. So it's very rare. I'd never heard of it before. It's very difficult to find in the history books. And so, yeah, not only do I want to keep the history alive, but I want people, adults, children, to just know what it did and know to value the service it had and the crews that flew it.
That's incredible. Well, thank you. I know we're fighting the clock here. I told you it would go fast. Thank you so much for coming all this way, making the amazing and adventurous trek we did last night to get you here in the middle of a snowstorm. And thank you for your service, for everything you and your crews and your personnel have done through aviation history and for the piece of history you're preserving today. So thank you for being here. Can't wait to go on stage with you tonight and discuss basically what we did here again before our live audience here. Again, just thank you for everything you've done.
Well, I figure I'm a relic. I fit right in here.
So. Not at all. Not at all. You do fit in, but you're not a relic. So, no, this is great. Well, thank you so much. I'm glad that we're not sitting in a 102-degree hangar like we were the last time we were together. Look forward to having you here tonight. If you guys are listening, we appreciate all your support of the Green Dot Podcast. Appreciate everybody that comes out also to the museum and to the speaker series to support the museum. Greatly appreciate it. So hope that you can get out here. It's usually a third Thursday of every month. And for all of you listening to the Green Dot Podcast, again, thank you so much for your support, your kind comments, your ratings. They mattered very deeply to us. We take great pride in it. And it's always fun to read and meet you guys at AirVenture and hear where you listen to us and what you're doing. A lot of people are cutting their grass listening to it. So I love stuff like that. So thank you for always sharing those comments with us. But we will wrap this episode up. And we're already planning our next few here. So keep tuning in with us. And we will catch you the next time when you're cleared to land on the Green Dot.